More recently, in the early 1990s, a classic handwriting analysis occurred when a CIA officer unexpectedly received a folded piece of silk from a fellow parishioner at a Catholic mass in Rangoon, Burma. The message, whispered the parishioner, had been written by a political prisoner who arranged to have it smuggled out of the heavily guarded prison and intended it to be given to the U.S. government. When the message on silk arrived at headquarters, an OTS graphologist was asked to assess the writing, but was given no information about the author or the circumstances of its acquisition. She studied the writing for several days, applying the standard techniques of letter and stroke measurements, and reported, "The writer possesses the genuine humility of those who are truly at peace and genuinely altruistic. Independent and individualistic, the writer is a true visionary, extraordinarily idealistic, but at the same time sophisticated, manipulative, savvy, and subtle. Peaceful conflict resolution is a fort." What the graphologist did not know was that her work was playing a key role in a major foreign policy decision. The assessment request came from a presidential envoy who was considering whether to meet with Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The meeting eventually occurred, and afterward, the diplomat credited the analysis with preparing him for an encounter with a skilled, dynamic leader with keen political instincts and a flair for the dramatic, and who, through courage and determination, had repeatedly faced down the Burmese military and endured. Aung San Suu Kyi received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1991 and the U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2000. The introduction to a 1954 National Security Assessment prepared for President Eisenhower, titled Report on the Covert Activities of the Central Intelligence Agency, asserted, "If the U.S. is to survive, long-standing American concepts of fair play must be reconsidered. We must learn to subvert, sabotage, and destroy our enemies by more clever, more sophisticated, and more effective methods than those used against us. It may become necessary that the American people will be made acquainted with, understand, and support this fundamentally repugnant philosophy." This stark perspective, articulated in a top-secret report prepared by a special study group headed by James H. Doolittle, reflected Washington's perceived danger from the Soviet Union in the mid-1950s. Assessment programs developed by TSS and TSD in response would earn respect and commendation for their operational value from case officers to the most senior agency officials. Yet it was precisely in the effort to understand, predict, and control the response and behavior of operational targets that the CIA has also drawn some of its harshest criticism. In the mid-1970s, a series of revelations about secret CIA programs from the 1950s and 1960s created a public image of an organization flooded with research programs on mind control, behavior modification, brainwashing, hypnosis, and out-of-control drug experimentation. For 5 years, from 1972 to 1977, CIA directors Helms, Schlesinger, Colby, Bush, and Turner were compelled to explain and defend programs and activities that management had begun closing down more than 10 years earlier. In April 1953, DCI Alan Dulles and Richard Helms, Assistant Deputy Director for Plans, authorized the technical services staff to conduct a super-secret behavioral research program under the codename MK-Ultra. Because the research involved recently synthesized drugs and pharmaceuticals, including LSD, the program became the responsibility of TSS's chemistry division, headed by Dr. Sidney Gottlieb. In concept, MK-Ultra descended from OSS's World War II research and subsequent authorized CIA drug testing programs Project Bluebird, 1950, and Project Artichoke, 1951. As chief of the OSS R&D organization, Stanley Lovell had worked on chemical and biological weapons. After the war, the Army Chemical Corps investigated the effect of drugs on interrogation for both offensive and defensive use. At the same time, the CIA was receiving reports that the Soviets were experimenting with so-called mind control techniques and drugs with some success. Fear that brainwashing techniques had been perfected by the Communist Chinese and the North Koreans added impetus to the mission to understand better the science of human behavior. Among the hallucinogenic drugs, LSD held a particular fascination, in part because of reports that the Soviets had shown an interest. CIA Director Dulles had voiced public alarm over America's limited understanding of how people's thinking could be influenced. Speaking from a prepared text to alumni of his alma mater, Princeton University, at Hot Springs, Virginia, on April 10, 1953, Dulles asserted that the U.S. government had been driven by the tensions of the Cold War to take positive steps to recognize psychological warfare and to play an active role in it. Dulles described a sinister battle for men's minds being waged by the Soviets and questioned whether America recognized the magnitude of the problem. He suggested the ongoing conflict be called brain warfare. The speech accused the Soviets of attempts at mass indoctrination of the population of countries they attempted to control and the perversion of minds of selected individuals. Under the latter circumstances, Dulles commented, a person's brain becomes a phonograph playing a disc put on its spindle by an outside genius over which it has no control. Before the month ended, the DCI had followed up on his public description of the threat by approving the ultra-secret MK-Ultra research program. Its intent would be to understand the human mind in order to counter Soviet capabilities for mind control and create tools that could be used by U.S. intelligence officers for agent recruitment and handling. The project would sponsor research and experimentation with any available chemical and biological materials and tap into expertise across the disciplines of psychology, psychiatry, pharmaceuticals, and hypnosis. During its 11-year existence, 1953 to 1964, MK-Ultra remained a tightly compartmentalized agency program that eventually involved 149 individual sub-projects. The technical services staff was the logical organizational location for the activity because before 1962, TSS had the scientific research responsibility for CIA. The letters MK denoted a TSS-managed program. The initial program was aimed primarily at creating new operational defensive capabilities to protect American assets from Soviet psychological or psychopharmaceutical manipulation. Understanding the effects of drugs and alcohol on human behavior would be a major focus. MK-Ultra research and development would also produce a handful of new offensive capabilities involving incapacitating and lethal toxins, which would eventually draw intense unfavorable attention and prove to be of little operational value. After MK-Ultra was approved by Dulles, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb reasoned that any drugs or chemicals developed would be of limited value without a means of covertly administering them. Gottlieb contacted John Mulholland, one of America's best-known and most respected magicians and an expert in sleight of hand, or close-up magic, for advice. His goal was to engage Mulholland to teach the techniques of magic, especially sleight of hand and misdirection, to case officers for delivering the MK-Ultra potions to their targets. Mulholland agreed to Gottlieb's request and proposed an outline for a training manual that would include background facts to correct erroneous facts about magic and enable a complete novice to learn to do those things which are required, descriptions of the covert techniques necessary to deliver material, chemicals, in a solid, liquid, or gaseous form. Included would be explanations of the necessary skills and instruction on how to learn them, examples and studies to explain how the techniques and mechanical aids could be employed in various operational circumstances. Mulholland put the cost of the manual at $3,000 and agreed to write it in a manner to provide total secrecy. To protect against the manual falling into the wrong hands, no references were made to agents or operatives. The intelligence officers were to be called performers, and covert actions would be referred to as tricks. His early draft of the manual contained 5 sections. 1. Underlying basis for the successful performance of tricks. 2. Background of the psychological principles by which they operate. 3. Tricks with loose solids. 4. tricks with liquids. 5. Tricks by which small objects may be obtained secretly. Mulholland noted, as sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 were written solely for use by men working alone, the manual needed 2 further sections. One section would give modified tricks and techniques of performance to be performed by women, and the other would describe tricks suitable for 2 or more people working in collaboration. By the winter of 1954, the manuscript, titled Some Operational Applications of the Art of Deception, was complete. Mulholland wrote in the introduction, "The purpose of this paper is to instruct the reader so he may learn to perform a variety of acts secretly and undetectably. In short, here are instructions in deception." With the first 100-page manual completed, Gottlieb invited Mulholland to work on a new project, on the application of the magician's art to the covert communication of information. The work would involve the application of techniques and principles employed by magicians, mind readers, etc., to communicate information and the development of new non-electrical techniques. In 1956, Gottlieb proposed expanding the scope of Mulholland's work to make Mr. Mulholland available as a consultant on various problems, for TSS and otherwise, as they evolve. These problems concern the application of the magician's technique to clandestine operations, such techniques to include surreptitious delivery of materials, deceptive movements and actions to cover normally prohibited activities, influencing choices and perceptions of other persons, various forms of disguise, covert signaling systems, etc. Mulholland's TSS work continued until 1958, when his failing health limited his ability to travel and work. The CIA's interest in solving intelligence problems using the skills of the magician, however, continued. In 1959, TSS considered revising and adapting Mulholland's work on deception techniques, magic, sleight of hand, signals, and on psychic phenomena. By 1962, it had become evident to CIA managers that MKUltra had produced few operationally usable products or new capabilities. A critical 1963 Inspector General report on the value and administration of MKUltra, combined with little support for the projects from the chiefs of the operational divisions, led to the decision to terminate the program. Before the end of the decade, all questionable sub-projects had been closed, leaving only a residue of non-controversial research contracts in place. At the ending of MKUltra, Gottlieb wrote, "It has become increasingly obvious over the last several years that the general area of biological and chemical control of human behavior had less and less relevance to current complex operations. On the scientific side, these materials and techniques are too unpredictable in their effect on individual human beings to be operationally useful. Operationally, the emerging group of new senior operations officers has shown a discerning and perhaps commendable distaste for utilizing these materials and techniques. They seem to realize that, in addition to moral and ethical considerations, the extreme sensitivity and security constraints of such operations effectively rule them out." MKUltra had encompassed a research area that used new, untested drugs to produce unanticipated effects on humans. It had been launched in the interest of national security by a DCI with the assistance of a senior officer, Richard Helms, who would eventually become DCI. However, in the 1960s, at a time when priorities for national security began to shift and standards for conducting experiments involving human subjects were evolving, controls over the MKUltra experiments that might have seemed appropriate in 1953 were judged inadequate. Ultimately, the CIA was cited for a failure of command and control for only 2 MKUltra drug experimentation projects, but both were dramatic and tainted every other activity associated with the project. For several years, TSD retained 11 grams of shellfish toxin in CIA classified storage, despite a presidential order that all material of this type be destroyed. While the retention represented the inaction of a single officer to comply with the order rather than an organizational effort to defy policy, and although no harm to any individual occurred, nor was any use ever made of the toxin, experimental or operational, the fact of its existence several years after the presidential directive reflected poorly on the CIA. In a second area of drug testing on unwitting human subjects, however, TSS's failure to obtain required official approval before conducting an LSD experiment that went horribly bad resulted in decades of personal tragedy, legal entanglements, and official inquiries. Dr. Frank Olson, a biochemist and researcher in biological warfare at the U.S. Army facility in Fort Detrick, Maryland, who worked on an MK-Ultra subproject, died in New York City on November 25, 1953. He fell to his death from a hotel room window more than 10 stories above the street below. Dr. Olson was likely suffering from delayed reactions caused by ingesting LSD several days earlier. The previous week, at a TSS-organized retreat at the Deep Creek Lodge in Western Maryland, Olson and several other researchers had shared a bottle of Cointreau. The liquor had been laced with 70 micrograms of LSD without their knowledge. Due to the political and operational sensitivities of the MK-Ultra program, the CIA withheld details of the circumstances surrounding Dr. Olson's death from Olson's family until they partially surfaced in the 1975 Rockefeller Commission investigation of CIA activities. Subsequently, the 1976 U.S. Senate Church Commission report added substantial additional details on the MK-Ultra program to the public record. Following the CIA Inspector General's internal report in 1963 and the 1976 Church report, a third airing of the MK-Ultra saga occurred in 1977. A few months after the Church Committee closed its investigation, some 8,000 pages of previously unidentified MK-Ultra financial records were discovered in response to a Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, inquiry on the project. The newly found documents had been filed with contract and financial records at the CIA's Record Center rather than under the MK-Ultra project title. These records had escaped the shredder in 1973 following DCI Helms's directive to Gottlieb to destroy all MK-Ultra research and operational files, and then were inadvertently missed during the record search in response to the Church Committee. Helms described his thinking on ordering destruction of the MK-Ultra records in a taped interview with journalist David Frost in May 1978. It was a conscious decision to destroy the records, but there were a whole series of things that involved Americans who had helped us with the various aspects of this testing, with whom we had a fiduciary relationship and whose participation we had agreed to keep secret. Since this was a time when both I and the fellow, presumably a reference to Dr. Gottlieb, who had been in charge of the program, were going to retire, there was no reason to have the stuff around anymore. We kept faith with the people who had helped us, and I see nothing wrong with that. The 1977 find was reported immediately to the White House and the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, SSCI, and congressional interest was rekindled. That year, the SSCI convened a joint hearing with Senator Edward Kennedy's Subcommittee on Health and Science and called DCI Stansfield Turner as the primary witness. Appearing before the committees, Turner testified that the documents added little information to what was already known about MK-Ultra's methods, experiments, operations, and the breadth of the program. The SSCI agreed, and the joint hearings were concluded after one session. However, the redacted materials, subsequently released under FOIA, became the basis for John Marx's The Search for the Manchurian Candidate, a best-selling account of CIA research in the 1950s and 1960s into human behavior. The negative publicity surrounding MK-Ultra far exceeded its modest contribution to intelligence, and the negative aspects of the program acquired undeserved legendary status in the mind of the public, as well as conspiracy theorists. Secret government-sponsored mind-control research, dangerous experiments on unwitting people, covert assassination tools, and white-coated chemists mixing unknown concoctions in hidden laboratories produced vivid images in the public's imagination. Virtually none of this was a reality, But more than five decades after Alan Dulles and Richard Helms initiated the ultra-secret program to counter what they believed to be a grave threat to free thought, MKUltra continues to generate public intrigue and controversy. The officer chosen to carry out the program, Sidney Gottlieb, did what he understood duty demanded, and paid a heavy personal price. The breadth of Gottlieb's life as a scientist, CIA official, builder of enduring intelligence capabilities, humanitarian, respected office director, and patriot was obscured even at his death on March 7, 1999. The Washington Post's headline on Gottlieb's obituary read, "CIA official Sidney Gottlieb, 80, dies. Directed tests with LSD in 50s, 60s. Like the headline, the first sentence mischaracterized Gottlieb and his work by focusing exclusively on mind control experiments and administration of drugs and LSD to unwitting human subjects. In fact, LSD, drug testing, and the procedures adopted had been a small part of the authorized MKUltra research program in the 15-person chemistry branch Gottlieb headed. Like many of their scientific contemporaries of the 1950s, TSS engineers applied their talents to national security work consistent with Gottlieb's policy. If it is technically possible, do it and put it on the shelf. The policymaker will decide whether it is ever used or not." The obituary ignored Gottlieb's remarkable contribution to America's security during his 11 years as deputy and director of the Technical Services Division. Under Gottlieb's leadership, TSD built worldwide clandestine technical capabilities critical to virtually all significant U.S. clandestine operations in the last third of the 20th century. 11 of the obituary's 12 paragraphs focused on drug, poisons, and mind control themes, while ignoring the fact that, with Gottlieb at its head, TSD conceived and built the technical devices that enabled the CIA to break the back of KGB counterintelligence inside the Soviet Union. Only the obituary's closing paragraph alluded to Gottlieb's humanitarian activities, that after retirement, he worked in a leprosy hospital in India for 18 months. Another Washington Post story published 2 years after Gottlieb's death and 3 months after the 9/11 terrorist attacks on America more accurately captured his life and work. The author observed that Gottlieb, the longest-serving chief of the CIA's technical services, had served his country as the coldest warrior while also living as a humble and compassionate man, an altruist eager to ease the miseries of the weak and sick. Yet, regardless of Gottlieb's public service and personal charity, his name will be inextricably linked to the 10-year MKUltra program and the sinister implications of associated words such as drugs, LSD, assassination, and mind control. No consensus is likely to emerge on how well MKUltra and Gottlieb's role served the national interest at a time when America's leaders sensed a clear and present danger from the Soviet threat. However, whenever the question is debated, an indisputable fact articulated in the final report of the 1976 Church Commission remains. Under the administrations of four presidents, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, the CIA has been responsive to the presidency throughout. No rogue elephant. Chapter 21, Cover and Disguise. They must lead a double life. It is a vexing existence. David Attlee Phillips, as quoted in The Literary Spy. False or assumed identities are a way of life for intelligence officers. While conducting their work, case officers and technical officers alike have learned to live normally with alias names by combining a con man's verbal skills to spin a plausible cover story with unassailable identification papers. The intelligence officer must convincingly establish that he is who and what he claims, even though it is all a fabrication. Most officers use a dozen or more different alias names during a career. For the CIA, creating false identities and their supporting documentation had its origin in 1942 in the Documentation Division of the OSS Research and Development Branch. Agents infiltrated by the OSS into occupied Europe required bulletproof identification papers, as the slightest whiff of duplicity could result in summary execution. OSS logbooks from October 1943 show requirements for fabricated documents such as French stamps, ID papers, and travel certificates. Agents dispatched behind German lines by OSS officer William Casey, later Director of Central Intelligence, were regular customers for the output of the OSS document fabrication shop in London between 1944 and 1945. The London operation, manned by an assortment of craftsmen and forgers, was a field component of Stanley Lovell's OSS R&D branch and evolved in the post-war years into the Document Intelligence Branch in the Operational Aids Division of the CIA's Office of Special Operations. In 1951, the CIA's consolidation of technical and scientific work in the Technical Services Staff included the capability to manufacture documents and identity papers. The significance of documentation for agency operations was reflected by the fact that three of TSS's six original divisions focused on some aspect of identity and documents. Hundreds of CIA officers working overseas, together with every agent dispatched into Eastern Europe or China, required an alias identity along with unassailable documents to back up an airtight cover story. The alias protected the agent's true identity, while the cover legitimized his presence in the area. TSS assembled a documentation team of artists, forgers, engravers, printers, papermakers, and photographers from OSS veterans, U.S. trade schools, and selected German and Japanese artisans who had originally learned their craft while working against the United States. Selection of appropriate cover for covert operatives was handled by a separate division within the DDP. TSS, and subsequently OTS, supported cover requirements by creating and/or reproducing paper or plastic documentation that a person would normally be expected to carry, such as passports, visas, licenses, credit cards, blood donor records, stationery, membership cards, business cards, and travel documents. Paper documents were at the heart of establishing an officer's identity and legitimacy, particularly in the decades before electronic databases. Historically, officially issued and printed documents carried on one's person were the standard form of identification for travelers, but in recent years, biometric identification and individual data stored on computer chips have become a required element of establishing identity. Fabricating high-quality identity documents has always been technically difficult and unforgiving. The OSS London shop reportedly checked documents 30 times before issuance to an agent going behind German lines. Minor mistakes or errors in printing, format, color, paper texture, inks, or missing security features in government-issued documents were quickly recognized in the home country. Immigration and customs officials, as well as border guards, were trained to spot false documentation. Likewise, local police were keenly aware of the typical contents of a traveler's wallet or purse. Hotel receptionists, ticket agents, and bank tellers were trained to be alert for fraudulent or counterfeit documents. A suspicious document opened the door for additional investigation and questioning that, once begun, often led to an unraveling of the bearer's cover story and endangered the larger operation. Intelligence officers working under an alias required documents that were perfect reproductions of official issuances and contained the current authentication features necessary for travel. Credit cards had to be signed with the same name and same script as the bearer's passport, driver's license, and club cards. Passports had to contain valid visas and entry and exit chops, rubber stamp impressions, that corresponded to travel reflected on other documents. Dates on airline stubs or train tickets had to be consistent with dates showing entry into a country. A production element within the OTS designed, printed, bound, laminated, and artificially aged the false documents, while a separate authentication division reviewed, verified, and prepared each document before issue. The separate authentication process confirmed that every piece of an individual's document package, including any government-issued identification papers, was complete, accurate, and up-to-date. Before issuance, authentication officers compared the document package to data maintained in CIA's exhaustive international document inventory and archives of current and historic samples of customs and immigration forms, rubber stamps, cachets, seals, passports, and travel paperwork. To ensure that the document inventory and knowledge of